here we are at another new season. If you're new here, we're so happy to have you. The goal of this podcast is to discuss the all-time favorite books of writers and readers alike and engage in a fun, casual literary discussion. And if you're returning, I'm immensely grateful you're here. This has just been a joy to make, and I love making these episodes, in this case, every other week. So you can expect new content every other Thursday. Now that we've gotten that housekeeping out of the way, let's jump into our episode with Belinda Huizhuan Tong. Welcome to Your Favorite Book. All right, so Belinda, welcome to the show. How are you doing this afternoon?
I am great. I am calling in from sunny Los Angeles. There's some construction happening nearby, but I'm very excited to talk to you.
I am really excited to have you. And normally, you know, I call people from all over the country and I'm like, oh, I'm so jealous of your beautiful sunny weather, but the heat's really beating down over here in the normally cold Midwest. So I think it's just warm across the board for everybody.
This is our reality now every summer.
Absolutely. Oh, gosh. Yeah. So holding all the existential dread behind, if we can jump into talking a little bit about this book. So I'm really excited to talk about both these books today. And before we get to all of that, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and about your work?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am a first generation Chinese American. I grew up in San Jose, California. My family is originally from Anhui Province in China. And they came here, like many in their generation, to pursue higher education. And so my book really draws on that family history. It's set largely in rural Anhui Province, in the ancestral village where my family is from, where my dad's side of the family is from, I should say. And it follows a man who has immigrated back to, he's immigrated to the U.S. and he receives news that his estranged father in China has gone missing. So he goes to look for him. And the story also unfolds the tale of how they became estranged.
Yeah, that's a great way of summing up kind of what this book does here and actually answers my first question, which was, you know, why this time period, why this particular place? And it sounds like a lot of this came from family history. So to pivot that question a little bit, what was the research process involved for something like this? You know, did you kind of start with a basis of family stories and go from there? How did that all kind of work for you when coming up with this?
Yeah, so there were two major parts of the research process. A large part of the book takes place in this village that's very near and dear to my family. So I visited the village, I talked to a lot of my relatives, and many of, you know, just the details of the everyday life were easy to fill in because of that. Oddly, one of the things that I found in that part of the research process was that I found it much easier to talk to other more distant relatives than my closer relatives, particularly my own dad, about his experiences. And I actually really, although the book is so close to his childhood, I didn't lean on my dad very much in researching this book, which made things harder at times. I made things harder on myself because of that.
That's really interesting because honestly, that mirrors a lot of what we're reading here on the page. I mean, without spoiling anything, you're finding a lot out about the father figure in this book, but often through hearsay, through secondhand information, you're kind of creating this story and creating this knowledge based on those other sources rather than getting to the heart of the matter, which is really interesting, kind of putting that in context.
Yeah. And it was, you know, that's not something I was even aware of until long after I'd finished the book. And I was already like reading through the draft and looking at my personal experience and seeing how many parallels there were. I think the book is very much about kind of how hard it is to say things within families, how hard it often is to tell the truth within families, especially when that truth talks, touches upon emotional wounds. And that very much was my own experience that I just had trouble talking to my dad about this story because I felt that it must be very emotionally close to him. And that is not the way that my family typically speaks to one another.
Got it. Okay, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And you do feel that anguish a little bit in the book of that lack of communication between the characters, which really made this book all the more compelling from a narrative perspective. I was telling you before we started recording, I really enjoyed this book. I kind of devoured it in like 2 or 3 days. I mean, and it's not a short book, but it reads so smoothly and you really get invested, even though we're skipping through a few different periods of time, we're jumping through a few different characters' perspectives, but it's all done very seamlessly. And one of the reasons the themes sort of carry through, one is that idea of communicating within families, but the other is just that idea of choosing kind of an intellectual life, a life of the mind, versus a more stable, sort of accepted for life, and you know the consequences of having those choices kind of put upon you and how that can kind of bring your life apart. And I really enjoyed kind of seeing that dichotomy. There's this idea that you kind of break down that like education's your only way out of poverty, but at the same time, your protagonist, I'm going to pronounce his name wrong, is it Yixian or Yixian or?
Oh, Tong Yitian is the main male protagonist, yeah.
Tian. Thank you. I have a feeling a few times during this discussion, I'm going to be asking you for pronunciations. And so bear with me with that, but thank you. So,
Thank you for asking instead of just barreling through. I appreciate it.
No, absolutely. I was reading this and I was like, you know, I'm going to clarify these questions, but Tang Yitian, essentially, he, you know, gets to pursue a lot of the intellectual life he's looking for, but he's not immune from poverty, from financial struggle, from some of the demons he's left behind. So it really just draws into perspective more of that complexity. And I really liked that about this book.
Yeah. One of the things that I felt I really wanted to write about was kind of like the loneliness of what it feels like to be the first of your kind to do something. And for Tang Yitian, that is to lead an intellectual life because it's so different from, you know, his family and what his ancestors have done, which is farming and living off the land. And so for him, it's a difficult experience because, you know, even as he is very successful in many ways later in his life, he gets to go to America. He's at this prestigious institution when we meet him. He still carries along a lot of that loneliness and history of his family and their particular history that isn't very speakable in the environment that he now finds himself in. And even as he's in like a loving marriage is something that he finds difficult to talk about. Once again, like the communication thing that we're talking about. And as a result, you know, it's something that he has to really navigate on his own. And it just comes with so much loneliness, despite the ways that his life probably looks a lot like what he would have dreamed for himself.
Yeah, it's a great way of putting it. I found him just a beautifully complex character, his relationships to his wife, to his mother, his father, his long lost friends. I mean, it was great seeing him kind of navigate the world because he's a more reserved, quiet, introspective character, but these situations are asking a lot of him and basically asking him to return to an area that he thought he would largely leave behind in many ways. And I don't know, he felt very real to me. And I think second only to Tang Yitian was Han Wen, sort of his counterpart in China. I was so drawn in by her struggle, her come up, so to speak, just felt immensely relatable. And she challenged my preconceived notions of what her conflict would be. I thought, I know I came into this thinking, you know, a main barrier in her way for taking exams and things like that would be sexism. Maybe she would be barred from exams entirely. And it was, you know, calling to my perspective, no, you're assuming things based on something you don't know. And her, obviously sexism plays a role in her life, but her conflict is much more complicated and multi-layered than that. And so her character definitely had me questioning certain notions that I had.
Yeah. It's so interesting that you say that, because I think you're right that she definitely, especially later on in her life, faces a set of expectations because of her gender. But I will say, like, the Cultural Revolution, this period of time in China that I'm writing about for part of the book, it was a time when gender existed in this complicated way where, yes, there were a lot of expectations and long-held cultural expectations around being a woman that were obviously still present within society. But there was another way where, as part of like the Communist Party's push for social equality, they actually pushed in a lot of ways for women to, be equal and have these equal opportunities. And so for Hanwen, at least for the early parts of the book, what ends up being more salient for her is not so much her gender, but the fact that she's a resident of the city and is as part of the forced urbanization campaign of that time, forced to relocate purportedly permanently at that time into the countryside.
And that was fascinating to read about because I had no idea something like that had ever occurred. And I was struggling with the idea of, these young people kind of leaving their homes and what they left behind to live largely without their families and then being just sent to this other area. How is that something you sort of grew up always knowing existed, or were there surprises along the way when you were researching that particular time period?
It was fascinating to me. I had always known about this, about the sent down youth, about this generation, because it was something that touched on so many people. I think the unofficial count now is that about 16 or 17 million urban youth at this time were sent down. So it intersected with most people's lives, and almost everyone who grew up in this time has a story of either them or a sibling who was sent down. And it was something that was just kind of pervasive in how people of my parents' generation talked about living through that period. My family did not personally go through it because they are a little bit, they were born a little bit later than the time period. And also my dad was originally from a rural area, so or the forced relocation campaign wasn't something that would have affected him. But when I started doing interviews for Hanwen's section of the book, as I was doing research, it was very easy to find many people who wanted to talk to me about their experiences because it had touched so many people.
Yeah, that I did not know it was quite to that scale. I mean, it felt pervasive in the book setting, but of course it's limited to a few characters. But no, this is, a widespread, countrywide phenomenon that affected a lot of people for a long period of time. And I'm just now learning about these things. I mean, that's part of the joys of literature. You learn things that you've never been aware of before from cultures that are not your own. It's one of the joys of reading. But another thing about this book, and this is totally different in a different direction, that I learned or sort of recontextualized is how Tang Yitian uses math to sort of process his thoughts. And because he, has this role in graduate studies in mathematics, and he uses it as a brainstorming, journaling technique to sort of make sense of his thoughts and feelings. And it called into mind, the idea that, people who are literary and are more, literature bent, avoid math and vice versa. There's this strict sort of line between a mathematical mind and a more literary artsy mind. And Tang Yitian has a little bit of both in him. I mean, his first love is more literature and history. That's what he really enjoyed. And then he turns to math due to other reasons. And it made me think, is math something that comes easy to you? Do you see that kind of line between math people and literary people? This sounds so simplistic wording it out this way, but it made me kind of think of math in a much more creative, sort of creative perspective, seeing how he uses it as a journaling device.
Totally, totally. And I absolutely, I mean, I understand why it may sound simplistic, but I think like this idea of being a math person or an artsy person is something that it's like definitely pervasive in the US and also pervasive in China. And it's interesting to me to see it kind of translate across multiple cultures. I originally studied economics when I was an undergrad, and I didn't start writing until after I graduated from college. And I'd always really enjoyed math. I did a lot of math as part of my study. And part of the reason why I actually put the math parts in the book was just because I was missing it and it was a fun thing for me to do. I think there is something really just like deeply satisfying about, mapping things out in this mathematical way, like defining functions. Things feel in many ways like clear cut and elegant to me in a way that writing is often elusive in fulfilling. And so it was really like when I started doing that stuff, it was an exercise for me to keep myself excited about writing this book and think about, okay, what new thing can I do while I'm writing?
Yeah, I think that's a great way of putting it, and I can definitely feel some of what you're saying about you're missing that aspect of your life. And I'm thinking back to and what you m make a point about how the educational system almost makes you choose. My parents grew up in India, and they often talk about it how when they were studying, you have to kind of make this choice between an arts track or a science track
Right.
pretty young in life. Like I think they were like 15, 16, where they had to kind of had to choose a way to go. And as someone who I'm double majored in college in sort of the sciences as well as in arts. And I was thinking, it's hard to choose. And I was grateful for the experience to kind of do a little bit of both. But in a lot of other cultures, or even in America to a certain extent, you have to pick one or the other, and it's to the exclusion of the other in some respect.
Totally. It's in America there, I agree, there is a sense of, I think you like kind of pledge your allegiance to one side or the other. And I certainly felt that pressure. But it is much more flexible compared to the system that I'd heard my parents grew up in, which was that when they applied for college, you basically at that point decide, am I going to test in the maths and sciences or am I testing in the humanities? And then that basically affects, what majors you're able to apply to, and affects the rest of your life. And there are very, very few stories. I mean, I actually am not sure if I know anyone from my parents' generation who is not still kind of in whatever field they were tracked into at that young age. And it's crazy to me, because I was in my early 20s after I left college, still very much figuring it out. And I'm very glad that I wasn't limited to what I'd chosen when I was 17 or 18.
Oh, totally. I know. I feel like I'd be still struggling my way through medical school, and I'm like, well, this is for me in the long run. So
Right, exactly.
sometimes you're grateful enough to be able to change your mind. But anyway, there's so much in this book that really, without spoiling anything, I just found this book to be, very rewarding just from a storytelling and craft perspective. The characters, come alive, come off the page. I know those all sound like cliches, but really the greatest thing about this book to me is just the pacing moves so wonderfully. It is an absorbing read. I think ultimately the mark of a great book, especially for me, is one that I just don't want to put down, and I want to see through to the end, and I'm not stalling while reading. And I certainly felt that sense of momentum with A Map for the Missing. So I definitely recommend everybody listening to check this one out. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much. That's so kind of you.
Absolutely. And so now that we're at this point, I want to transition over to the book you chose for this episode, which is a book I had never heard of. It took me a little while to track down. My library system only had like one copy of it, and I grabbed it from somewhere, but I found it. And that is The Song of Everlasting Sorrow by Wang Anyi. I'm not sure if I'm saying her name correctly.
Wang Ani. Yeah, pretty close.
Okay, Wang Anyi. And this book, was translated from Chinese into English. It's subtitled A Novel of Shanghai, and I'll talk about that subtitle as I go. But for everyone who also, like me, hadn't heard of this book, a brief summary. So this was written about 1995, and it tracks the life of a former beauty queen, Wang Qiyao. Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah, Chia. Yeah, that's quite close.
Okay. Wang Qiyao. Through 4 decades of her life in 20th century China, and how the country changes around her maturity and growth through life, her especially tragic life, so to speak. And I'm interested in knowing, when did you first read this book, and what drew you to it?
I had not ever heard of it either when I was growing up. And it also, I had some semblance of, who are some of the big names in Chinese literature. It's like Moyan, Yuhua, and I hadn't heard Wang Anyi's name come up. I moved to China. I lived in China for a couple of years as an adult. And right before I moved there, I had wanted to just read some literature that had originally been written in Chinese, just to kind of see a different perspective than, whatever the news perspective that I was mostly getting. And this was one of the books that had come up, and when I was researching major modern novels about China. And so I picked it up, and it was by far, the most affecting of the books that I read. And it was, I think, the most lasting impression it made on me was just the humanity with which it portrayed the characters of Shanghai.
I think the humanity, that's a great point about this book. And as we get into the content, I can totally see, that need to try to find literature based in the country that you're coming from, because I'm thinking of it from my perspective. Growing up, I had read lots of Indian Americans, lots of diaspora writers, but very few based in writing about the country itself. Very few writers in India, based in India. And there's only a few I can think of that I read sort of in my formula in my formative years, and it's really different, and it feels like it's part of something you're not really connecting to until you're reading modern literature coming out of the country itself and not just from the diaspora. It's part of having that well-rounded, perspective on a place.
Absolutely. And I felt that the experience of reading this was so different from the experience of reading, as you said, Chinese diaspora writers. It was also really different from reading about people in the news who had lived through the Cultural Revolution period, who had lived through the 40s and 50s in China. And it just made me think a lot about, and I think this is also a theme of the book, that, as a diasporic writer, just someone who had did not live through this period or did not grow up in China. And a lot of the times when I think about China, it is through the lens of major historical events that have happened in that country. It's through, the lens of the Cultural Revolution or through the lens of, the rapid rise China has had since the 80s. And there's a way that I think that history can dominate, my conception of it, or our conceptions of it, in a way that kind of displaces the actual humanity of people who lived through that time, and the individual choices they're making, and the fact that they're living lives just like us. And I felt that that was very much present in this book, that, these characters are living through incredibly tumultuous times. But we never lose sight of their inner emotional lives and the very human struggles that still exist, even as history is being made around them.
Yeah, that's a great point. They live full, thought-provoking, evocative lives that are rich with, romantic tragedy, and not they're not dictated only by politics. They have friendships and relationships and hobbies and interests, and they're well-rounded characters. And I like how you draw the distinction versus, reading fiction versus reading just news articles about these events. You can be as informed about all the current events that you can, but there's something that fiction gives you, and that's sort of that well-rounded character perspective that these are people living through these times and not just statistics and not just events and not just sort of, voiceless figures on a page. There's something a lot more to it when you take a few stories and put them into fiction that can be vastly overlooked.
Absolutely. And I feel that as someone reading about China, particularly, I'm often really frustrated reading news coverage, because I think so much of it is through the lens of China as this authoritarian country. There's a dictatorship, the politics are awful. All of these things are very true. And yet I feel like it comes to completely dominate the narrative. And oftentimes when I read articles about, what is happening in Chinese society, it portrays Chinese people as just, subjects that things are happening to, or maybe the word is objects that things are happening to, rather than people who still have their own choices and are still, going through the dramas of life that we go through. And I think fiction, as you said, is really ripe for portraying that part of a person's life. And it would be a shame, to read a novel where it is still just perpetrating the same narrative that we hear from the news.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And getting into the novel itself, so sort of from a craft perspective, so I'll be totally honest, this was a hard book for me to get into, especially from the beginning. I think it's because, the novel is subtitled This Novel of Shanghai, and this is a book that's very much, even though we're following this central character,
this book is very setting first, you know, it establishes where we are kind of down to every sort of detail that we get here. And it is beautifully crafted. I mean, each individual sentence and paragraph is ripe with information and ripe with image, but there's a lot here. There's a lot on the page. It takes us, I think, about 20 pages to even meet our protagonist. We're establishing a setting. We're establishing the various settings that we're in. And that can definitely bog down maybe a reader accustomed to sort of character first in fiction. It often made me wonder, you know, is this something unique to this book? Is this unique to writers who are writing in China of this time, that maybe that setting first perspective is more common and I'm not used to it? I'm not sure if you have any perspective on that, sort of the setting first versus character first, or I'm kind of reducing it sort of unnecessarily here.
Yeah, I'm not an expert in Chinese literature, so I can't speak to whether or not this is common for writers of this era, and I won't try to make any claims to that. I will say, I totally felt the same way as you, though. More so, I actually reread the book before our conversation, more so this time than my first time reading it. And I wondered if that was because since I first read this book, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, maybe a little bit more than that, before I had done an MFA and before I'd heard a lot of ideas about what good fiction should be. And I remember the first time I read this book, I was pretty much engrossed from the first page. And this time, you know, post all my creative writing education, I had much more of the experience of going through those first 30 pages about Shanghai, which, as you said, are deep in the minutiae, repetitive at some points, I would say. I was like, is this really necessary? You know, it just kind of ran counter to a lot of my ideas of what good fiction should be, quote unquote. And yeah, it was an interesting experience. I do love, though, I will say that, you know, it's called A Novel of Shanghai. Wang Anyi is a Shanghainese writer, and you can just feel so deeply her love for the city, and how motivated she is, how inspired she is by it to want to capture every single rhythm and detail of the city. And I think that it's meaningful to me to read that and to come into contact with an author trying to put that on the page.
Yeah, the love definitely comes through. This is someone who knows her hometown sort of backwards and forwards, knows all it has to offer. She's able to see it, you know, its positives as well as its negatives. She's really able to take a close look at that. And this is especially true as we get to Wang Qiao, as we, you know, we start reading. And what I find really interesting about her as a character is she herself is not really a character more than she is kind of what she's more what she represents and the role that she plays in this changing China. And you know, understanding that definitely improved my enjoyment of the book, was sort of taking a step back and realizing what she's representing and how she's kind of defined by how others are seeing her. She's this glamorous young woman, and her life is sort of defined by her physical beauty for much of this book. She had me thinking a lot about like Marilyn Monroe, for example, someone who is consumed by others in some respect and, you know, is limited by how she is perceived, and her roles are limited and her gaze is limited as a result. And that eventually in many ways leads to sort of the tragedies that she faces. And I just, once I sort of understood her role and how that changes as she gets older and the culture changes, I just found that aspect of her very interesting.
Yes, totally. It's very interesting because the book, you know, it's when it introduces Wang Qiao, that one of the first things that it says about her, it doesn't talk about Wang Qiao as a singular character, but as a type, right? It says like there are many Wang Qiaos in the city. And the narrator at that point, I felt, was coming from that vantage point of the people who are gazing at this type of woman, and who feel something is so illustrious about her. And I think it's so interesting because once we do get into the part of the story that's dealing with the singular character of Wang Qiao, we see sort of that sheen of her life broken down. And actually, we see so much of the tragedy of being a person who is so often looked at and gazed at and made to represent something in the eyes of others. And so I just thought it was interesting to that the way into the story of looking at her as part of this plurality was so interesting.
Yeah, I the plurality, that part of it, definitely, I immediately hooked into that. And that was the part I kind of highlighted here. And, you know, sort of understanding that that group, knowing that Wang Qiao, there's many of them, and we don't know all of their names, and they walk among us, and there's been many of them. And, you know, as she gets older, she starts to represent kind of a nostalgia for that time more than sort of herself as a person. And I often found myself wondering, you know, you think about, you know, nostalgia here. I'm wondering if nostalgia is a major theme that the author is trying to show us, or if just seeing a former beauty queen like Wang Qiao sort of get older and deal with getting older, if that's the sort of nostalgia that we're feeling, or if it's more a cultural nostalgia. It was hard to kind of pick apart that without all the necessary context. But those were the questions that kept coming to mind.
Right, right. And nostalgia is such an interesting concept to me, because I think in many ways, you know, we talk about it warmly when, you know, I say like I have nostalgic feelings for my childhood. It you know, comes with a connotation of a kind of warmth towards your childhood. But in this book, I think we do encounter a kind of nostalgia. I would agree with you that that's very much present here. But we also, I think, really encounter its pitfalls. You know, with towards the end of the book, there's this character who's a very young man who kind of falls in love with Wang Qiao when she's an older woman, because she represents this older era of Shanghai. And in a way, I think that nostalgia traps Wang Qiao in a way of being someone from the past. I think throughout the entire book, we're looking at various gazes, and we're encountering here a particular gaze in which this character is saying, you have to represent this woman from the past. I'm not allowing you in a way to be the person you are in the present. And I think in that way, the book is kind of showing us how nostalgia can be a painful thing, and it can be a painful thing to have enacted upon you, which is what happens to Wang Qiao. I do know during the time period that Wang Anyi was writing this book, there was just a very large wave of nostalgia for, you know, old Shanghai, like 40s, 50s, 60s Shanghai. And I do wonder if perhaps she is speaking a little bit to, you know, the pitfalls of trying to hold on so deeply to a place that no longer exists.
Yeah, yeah. That definitely was coming through to me. And another thing about this book that really captured me and definitely kept me reading at certain parts is there's so much petty gossip.
Yeah.
And like, little, and it's not humorous, but there are elements of humor to it. But I'm thinking about, you know, Wang Qiao's relationships with her classmates, especially Jiang Lily, just that complicated relationship. And then Mr. Cheng comes in, and there's just so much that's not spoken out loud, but so much tension between all of these people that no one is able to express. And it's frustrating from a reader perspective, but also intensely engrossing. And so just from almost a petty gossip perspective, this just felt very engaging.
Yeah, totally. I feel that, I think it was Alice Munro said something like, you know, a writer must always have a good ear for gossip. Mm-hmm. And I totally agree with that. Like, I feel that, you know, gossip is the way that our ancestors have been telling stories, and telling stories with huge stakes for generations and generations. And so it totally makes sense that, you know, when we're in this enclosed space of the Longtong of this book, gossip is what is, you know, kind of the engine for how these people are relating to one another, and how characters make themselves known in the world, how they make their opinions known. And it's all just so fascinating to read about.
it's one of the first things that Wang Anyi mentions as this novel opens. It's, here are the Longtang apartments, here are the pigeons, and here's the gossip. These are the three things you need to know about this place. And all three of these things end up, you know, playing their roles, and the gossip especially, you know, it just really draws you into these characters in a way that other kinds of dialogue really can't, and keeps you engaged. I don't know. Yeah. So this book, definitely, I'd say if you were to pick it up, give yourself time to sort of read and digest it, because it is dense, it is detailed, but ultimately it is a very thorough portrait of a place and of a time. And Wang Qiyao's, you know, sort of tragic story is very compelling and only gets more engaging the older she gets. So definitely interesting, and one it was never on my radar before.
Yeah, I'm glad that you were able to read it, and I would agree with all of that. If anyone is picking it up, just to give it at least until you get maybe 30 pages into Wang Qiyao's story, because I think that's when the book really picks up.
Absolutely. And now to sort of transition over to, you know, other recommendations. So I was at first thinking, you know, I haven't read a lot of books written by Chinese writers in general. I haven't read a lot of books, you know, with these particular styles and time periods. But one book I kept thinking about, it's actually the book of a recent podcast guest that we had on the show, is Nivo's Siren Queen, kept coming to mind while I was reading this. And for those of you that might have listened to the Siren Queen episode, so that one was very much takes place in the United States, but it is an old Hollywood glamour. And we have a young Asian starlet who is trying to find sort of her way through sort of the dark glamour of this this Hollywood type of era. It's very much entrenched in the 30s, so a little older, different setting, but it has some of that dark undercurrent of what it means to be beautiful or what it means to be not beautiful and be consumed by sort of the public eye. And so that was a book that kept coming to mind for me as sort of a modern American counterpart. But Belinda, I'm interested in hearing from you. What are some books that you might recommend?
Yeah, so thematically, I found this book to be really in conversation with a lot of Alice Munro's work, actually, just in the themes of, you know, what does it feel like to be looked at and relationships between women, that kind of nuanced portrayal. My favorite Alice Munro book of short stories is something I've been meaning to tell you, but all of them are really great. And I think there are a lot of parallels. I would also recommend Wang Anyi's other book called Baotown. I think it's been translated into a number of different titles, but I think the latest one is Baotown, which is very different. Wang Anyi was actually, she was a sent down youth of, like Han Wen was in my novel. And she was sent down to Anhui province where my novel takes place. And she had my perception is a very negative experience, but she wrote Baotown about a village, and it's very much inspired, I think, by her time in the village. And it's just a very mystical, quiet novel. It's very different from The Song of Everlasting Sorrow, but it also is very much a novel about a specific place where the rhythms of the place are clearly top of the author's mind.
Yeah, very interesting. I love all those parallels that you brought in. And I'm curious, actually, this goes back to the book. Did you read this book in translation? Did you read this book in Chinese? Have you read it in both languages?
I've read it in English, and I have tried to read it in translation, but it is incredibly difficult for me. I would say it probably takes me like 10 minutes to read one page in Chinese in a way that... you know, diminishes my appreciation of the work because I'm so much in the technical minutiae of reading. So my only real encounter with it is in English right now, but I would love to be able to read it in Chinese one day.
Yeah, that was what I was thinking about, because I barely speak Malayalam, which is the language I grew up in, let alone read it. And I always just think, you know, I've read books in translation, but I was like, what is it? What would it be like to read this in its original text? And that's always something in the back of my head. But in English, this is a beautifully translated book. I mean, the imagery is totally there. I'll wonder about its Chinese, but I certainly hope that it is faithful.
Yeah, I think the translator did an excellent job based on, you know, my limited knowledge and based on what I've read from other Chinese literature scholars.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And so, Belinda, before we close out today, can you tell us a little bit about where we can find you and where we can find your book?
Yeah, so you can find me online. I am on Instagram at my name. It's Belinda.Huijian-Tong. I'm on Twitter at Belinda. My book is going to be out on August 9th, which is a few days from when we're recording this.
Yes.
Right now, there are a couple of places running pre-order campaigns, and they will continue to run campaigns, I think, after the book comes out. The bookstore I'd like to plug for everyone is this wonderful bookstore in New York called You and Me Books, which is an Asian American owned bookstore. I believe it's the first in the country, is what I've heard, and you can order a signed copy from their website. If you're in DC, Politics and Prose, the iconic DC bookstore is also running my book as part of their signed first editions collection. So either of
Love
those
it.
options, yeah, or wherever you buy your books, really.
Love an indie bookstore shout out. I'm so glad you mentioned You and Me Books. I used to live in New York, and then once I left, then they opened up this place. I'm like, where was this when I lived here? Like, I totally would have been there all the time. And but I'm everything I've heard about You and Me Books has been fabulous. And so yeah, we'll definitely have links to purchase the book. I certainly recommend that you pick this up. And Belinda, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks all of you for listening. As a reminder, we have episodes every other Thursday, interviews with writers and readers alike. If you enjoy the show, please let us know. You can rate and review on almost every podcast platform. And you can also follow us on Instagram and Twitter at YFB Podcast. Till then, have fun and happy reading.